DW Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, April the 10th. Hello and a warm welcome to DW's Africa Link program. I am Eunice Wanjiru.
With me, Zipporah Nyambura. Remember, we are also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Feel free to share this audio and tell us what you think on the stories we are covering.
Coming up, Ugandan opposition politician and musician Bobi Wine confirms he will run for presidency in the next elections.
Not that we are looking at the presidency in itself as an end, but because we know that our biggest problem is misgovernance. So yes, we are challenging for the presidency in the next presidential election.
Don't miss that exclusive interview with Bobi Wine. We will also get to hear from Sudanese British billionaire Mo Ibrahim speaking out on the ongoing protest in Sudan. He's calling on President Omar al-Bashir to respect the will of the people.
The Sudanese people are fed up. Unfortunately, Bashir, having got the decency of President Bouteflika, who was decent enough to say, I'm resigning and I'm sorry.
These are just some of the stories that we've lined up for you, but first, some world news in brief.
DW News.
This is DW News with me, Jin Nyingi. Several people have been taken hostage and a policeman killed in Niger in an attack by Boko Haram, AFP reports. The militants, some of whom were believed to be wearing suicide vests, carried out the attack in Difa City, the area which is close to northeastern Nigeria, borders Lake Chad Basin, and has repeatedly suffered Boko Haram attacks. South Sudan's rivals, President Salva Kiir and rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar, have begun a retreat at the Vatican aimed at finding a path to a lasting peace. Kiir and Machar last saw each other in October last year, shortly after the signing of a power-sharing deal, when Machar made a brief return to Juba for the first time since fleeing on foot in 2016. The two men met with the Pope Francis, who held a mass in St. Peter's Square.
L'atteggiamento più pericoloso di ogni vita cristiana.
What is the most dangerous attitude of every Christian life? Do you know what it is? Pride. This is the most dangerous attitude of every Christian life. Pride. Those who criticize others are proud. None of us is perfect. Nobody.
Orgogliosa. Nessuno di noi è perfetto. Nessuno.
In Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be headed towards a historic fifth term as prime minister. With the vote count almost complete, Netanyahu's Likud party and its traditional political allies have a solid majority in parliament. One of the first reactions came from U.S. President Donald Trump.
I'd like to congratulate Bibi Netanyahu. It looks like that race has been won by him. It may be a little early, but I'm hearing he's won it and won it in good fashion. So he's been a great ally and he's a friend. That was a well thought out race.
A German government spokesperson said it was important for Israel to quickly build a new government as Israel is located in a region with enormous challenges. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. European leaders are gathering for an emergency Brexit summit in Brussels later today and are expected to grant a second delay to the UK's departure from the bloc. British Prime Minister Theresa May has been facing members of parliament in her weekly question and answer session. May is requesting a short extension to Brexit until the 30th of June, but EU leaders are expected to grant a longer delay with conditions. May says it's no one's interest for Britain to leave the EU without a deal. The government in Zimbabwe says the remains of thousands of people killed by the military during the 80s will be exhumed and given a proper burial. Between 10,000 and 20,000 Zimbabweans in Matabeleland were killed in what was known as Gukurahundi massacres. The victims were seen as the supporters of former President Robert Mugabe rival Joshua Nkomo. For more news and information, head on to our Facebook page, DW Africa. My name is Jen Nyingi.
This is DW's Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Eunice Wanjiru. Thank you to all of you listening to us on our Facebook page. I see CC Bell, Epignosis, and JB Muwonge. Thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure to leave us your comments on the reports that we are going to cover.
For sure. We start with our exclusive interview. Uganda's opposition politician and musician Bobby Wine has confirmed he will be vying for the country's top seat in the general elections to be held in 2 years' time. He will take on 74-year-old Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power for over 30 years.
Bobby Wine, whose real name is Robert Chagulanyi, has been a thorn in Museveni's presidency. He was arrested last year on treason charges and says he was tortured in detention. DW's Eddie Mica Jr. talked to him in an exclusive interview in Berlin, where he is attending a conference on freedom of expression.
It's the first and most important freedom. When it's natural, when you hurt, you cry. When you're asking for something or you want to communicate something, you speak out. That's the whole meaning of my musical career, which I find so dear. I got into music because I had something to say, because I wanted to speak out for myself and for those that are in the same world with me. So that freedom is so dear to me.
But last year was quite a tough year for you. You were imprisoned, you were beating up. I mean, how safe do you feel now, still going for this?
Well, I'm certainly not safe, but neither is anybody. Those like me who speak out, and indeed the many who are silent, we are all unsafe. I mean, the case in Uganda is a complex one because we are living in a regime that is 34 years old and will not tolerate anything that is not its line of thinking. So anybody who speaks out, especially against the atrocities and excesses of the regime, is at risk of facing the worst.
You've already mentioned that you are considering running for president. Maybe for the first time, you can clarify everything with Deutsche Welle. Have you decided now? Are you running for president in the next election?
First, I have to say it's not just about me. So when you're asking, it should not be like me, it should be like we. And yes, I and my team are considering challenging Museveni in the next presidential election. Not that we are looking at the presidency in itself as an end, but because we know that our biggest problem is misgovernance, and we cannot solve that until we get into leadership ourselves. So yes, we are challenging for the presidency in the next presidential election that is less than 2 years away from here.
So many believe Mobutu Muntu collusion with him will probably enhance your chances. What do you say to that, ex-general?
Yeah, General Mobutu Muntu is a very disciplined person. We are working very closely together. We seem to be speaking from the same page, and indeed we have the same values held together. Our biggest problem in Uganda has been the disunity in the opposition that has been part of the factors that have propped up the regime to 33 years.
Now, recently, we all know what happened in Algeria. How feasible do you think that process is going to be like in Uganda?
Well, the great Mandela taught us that it always seems impossible until it's done. All these despots, especially in Africa, seemed invincible until they are gone. You saw it with Gaddafi, you saw it with Yahya Jammeh, you saw it recently in the Congo, and now, just a few days ago, you saw it in Algeria. Be sure, sooner or later, Museveni will be no more.
Ugandan opposition politician and musician Bobby Wine. For more on that interview, visit our homepage, dw.com/Africa.
And also, it is on our Facebook page, so make sure to look through that. Now, we have comments coming in here. Med Saku is saying, you give us confidence. It's true. He's talking about Bobby Wine.
And Ok Generous in Christ, although that's a very funny name, says, I'm not Ugandan, but I love this guy for his courage and his ideology.
Now we proceed on to the world stories. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to secure a record fifth term in office with the support of right-wing parties, according to a near-complete unofficial election result.
With over 90% of the vote counted, Netanyahu's party and its traditional political allies were in command, beating his closest rival, centrist ex-military chief Benny Gantz. As Kathleen Schuster reports, Israelis have mixed reactions on the poll results.
The Laila Shel Nitzachon Adir! Adir!
It's a night of tremendous victory. I was very moved that the nation of Israel once again entrusted me for the fifth time, and with an even greater trust.
Ve'od emun gadol yoter.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in an upbeat mood as he addressed cheering supporters for coming out in large numbers to vote for him. His party, Likud, and right-wing allies are set to be the largest bloc with 65 seats in the 120-seat parliament. But Netanyahu's main challenger, Benny Gantz, said the results weren't final yet. Among Israelis, there were mixed reactions from supporters of both candidates.
I was quite stunned and sad. I think I am a bit naive, because I thought there'll be a change here.
I'm very pleased about it because I think Netanyahu is a great leader. Israel is a strong country, it's a wealth country, and I think it will be better now. I don't think that Gantz and Lapid have enough experience.
I'm devastated, absolutely devastated. We're surrounded by right-wing radical people who want to annex more territories. In this part, we're never going to have peace, and it's the shock of my life. I was sure that this time we would win.
I got what I wanted, just because, in my opinion, there's no better alternative.
However, the 69-year-old is facing corruption charges. The attorney general has announced he intends to indict Netanyahu for corruption and breach of trust, pending a hearing in the coming weeks.
Kathleen Schuster with that report. Moving on, Sudanese-British billionaire and founder of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, Mohamed Mo Ibrahim, has called on President Omar el-Bashir to step down following the ongoing deadly protest in Sudan.
Ibrahim, whose foundation seeks to promote good governance in Africa, said the protests are an indication of a people tired of a failed regime. He was speaking to DW.
We are about governance. We're trying to improve governance everywhere. And it was clear that the Sudanese people are fed up with a government which came 30 years ago by military coup, ran the country with iron fist, and they stole the money. They fought their own people in the south, in Darfur, committed endless crimes. Unfortunately, Bashir haven't got the decency of President Bouteflika, who was decent enough to say, I'm resigning and I'm sorry. Nobody was killed. Nobody in Sudan, at least 55, 60 people have been killed. We're waiting for Bashir to try to apologize for all the people he killed, what he did to the country, and I hope we don't wait long.
Mo Ibrahim wanted to say that the migration of Africans to Europe and North America should be viewed as a positive phenomenon and not a threat warning, as it had given rise to many false misconceptions. Take a listen.
I think our data showed that the misconceptions about African migrations should be clarified. African migrants are not overwhelming Europe or the rest of the world. Data shows that of all immigrants last year, only 14% were African. Now, this 14% of African migrants, 70 or 80% of them actually migrated into Africa from one African country to another African country. Why are they migrating? Because they want to find a job, they want to work. They do not migrate because they want to another country and sleep.
Speaking to DW, that is Sudanese British entrepreneur and billionaire Mo Ibrahim.
And we have another story that we are following up. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and former rebel leader Machar are starting a two-day spiritual retreat today hosted by Pope Francis at the Vatican. We asked if you think that this new move by the Vatican will work, and Blasung Ansang says it doesn't have to try.
Tiko is saying with God all things are possible.
I like how people are positive. Yes. Ntong Vo says, what a great move on the part of the Pope. People are tired of this war. Let us start to do the talk.
And finally, Odu Homoe is saying, let's pray for them that they work together for the common good of their people and country. Thank you so much for the comments that you're bringing in. Thank you so much to all of you also on our Facebook page. Stay tuned. I'm seeing Mwajuma Ne, Prince Ugo. Thank you. Keep it Africa Link. You're listening to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from Bonn, Germany. I'm Eunice Wanjiru.
With me, Zipporah Nyambura. Welcome aboard, those of you listening to us on our partner radio stations and, of course, on our Facebook Live there. Keep telling us what you think about these stories that we are talking about. Of course, we are happy to hear from you, and remember to share the audio as well.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, we'll get to hear from widows whose husbands were killed during the Rwandan genocide.
I thank God that I survived, together with my children. After the genocide, we didn't have a place you can call home, and there was nothing to eat. In short, life was not easy at all.
Be sure you do not miss that story. We will also have a report from Kenya on how one organization is replanting trees using indigenous seeds that thrive in all kinds of weather. Don't miss out. But first we go to Nigeria, where the country's President Muhammadu Buhari cut short his trip to the United Arab Emirates and returned to Abuja ahead of a schedule to chair the weekly cabinet session.
Buhari's decision to return ahead of time is said to be connected to the rise in cases of violence in the northwest of the country. Nigerians have been blaming the president for not showing any interest in the dire situation. I spoke to DW's Waisu Idris and wanted to find out more about how Nigerians have been reacting.
Well, Nigerians are divided about his return. There are people who are taking it serious about the issue of the insecurity following so many killings ongoing by armed bandits and even clashes in some parts of Kaduna and the Boko Haram in the northeast. But some see it as just symbolic because the president, what he can do while he's in Nigeria, he can equally do from there, because it's an issue of the team he has and the kind of power and the kind of directives he can give. I have interviewed Barrister Minasara Umar, who is a public affairs analyst, on is Buhari really in control looking at what is happening? And this is what he has to say.
His return is symbolic, as per Section 130 of the Constitution that says he is the Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. It is symbolic. But essentially speaking, whether he is around or he is not around, there should be entrenched architecture to deal with the issue of any security breach in the country. He is to be held responsible. He is to be held for the failure of anything. We are seeing clear case of abuse of power.
What has the new government done so far in terms of the security of its citizens?
Well, basically nothing new. The only new thing one can look at and say is a decision taken while he was away, when the Inspector General of Police and the DG, Nigerian Intelligence Agency, and the Department for State Security Service had a press conference on Sunday saying that they now ban mining activities in Zamfara State, which more or less was accused by so many people looking at it. Why do you just ban it? If you know that there is link between the intelligence you have between the armed bandits and those who are mining, get them punished. So, and then they launch an operation on Kaduna Abuja Road, which has been notorious for kidnappings. But there are so many of these operations launched by the police, by the army, countless, without seeing really any impact. So to many Nigerians, the new government has not done anything that they can say and show on this issue of insecurity.
For a while now, attacks have been happening in Buhari's home state, Katsina State. Do we know why this is the case?
Yeah, Katsina, some part of it has neighborhood with Zamfara, where is the epic of the problem. So it's easy for them to cross to Katsina and cause a lot of havoc. Whenever there are military attacks there, they always either run to part of Kaduna, up to Abuja axis, or part of Katsina. That is why Katsina has been in the news now and is more or less their new haven where they easily operate.
I was speaking to Wise Idris in Abuja.
If you're listening to us from Nigeria, tell us what you think. Is it safe? We are eager to know how the situation is. Tell us right here on DW Africa.
On the spot.
Rwanda this week continues to remember victims of the 1994 genocide committed against the Tutsis. For many survivors, among them widows whose husbands were killed during the genocide, the month of April always brings back sad memories.
Despite support from the government and civil society groups, Many genocide women still suffer from trauma and are unable to reconcile with those who killed their husbands. Many of them live in a village built specially for them by the Association of Genocide Widows in Rwanda. DW's Isaac Mugabe went to visit and sent this report.
The village of Hope on the outskirts of Kigali is home for a group of genocide widows whose husbands were killed during the 100 days when Rwanda turned into a killing field like the world had never witnessed before. It's more than 140 houses were constructed for the widows since their homes had been destroyed by marauding militias. Mukakamari Valentine is one of the women living here. Previously, like other widows, she had lived alone in a partly demolished house and living there with a 3-month-old baby left after the genocide was hell on earth, she told me. She still suffers from bouts of depression.
After the genocide, I was left with many scars. My husband and I had been married for just a year when he was murdered. He was a Tutsi and had been put on the list of people to be killed. Even though the scars have healed, there's still a long road to reconciliation. But I forgave the killers, and I see everyone now as a Rwandan.
Mukamnana Vedian has a similar story. She suddenly found herself alone with 4 young children.
I lost my husband during the genocide, so you can imagine life has not been easy for me. And with 4 kids to take care of, you can also imagine the challenges. I thank God that I survived, together with my children. After the genocide, we didn't have a place you can call home, and there was nothing to eat. In short, life was not easy at all.
Some of the widows have been able to find new partners, while others chose to remain single. They have been unable to come to terms with the brutal loss of their husbands, as Mukakamari explains.
I couldn't trust anyone. You must picture a neighbor that you trusted, with whom you worked together, turning against you and accusing you of being a Tutsi. These are the people who destroyed my house. It's still in ruins. I was lucky that I wasn't raped like other women.
I also spoke to Chantal Muhoza, an activist, feminist, and founder of the non-government organization Spectra that seeks justice for young girls and women. I asked her whether the genocide widows have really been able to reconcile with their past.
It's living a nightmare from every day, from every night. So that's why it's really difficult. So they need a continuous system where they can be supported, where they can be going every day, every night, to be supported mentally, to process about things that are going on over time, even today, even 25 years later. These women are still suffering from this.
Today, 25 years after the genocide, highlighting one's ethnic identity can be seen as an assault on the country's very existence. The government's mantra is everyone is a Rwandan, neither Hutu nor Tutsi, and people have to foster unity and reconciliation. But for many genocide widows, the trauma is still very real. Only time will tell whether the genocide widows will finally succeed in overcoming the trauma they've lived with for 25 years.
Isaac Mugabe there reporting.
And I like what Isaac just said, moving forward, because the first comment here from Patrick Chezoka is talking about that. He's saying we must put our differences apart and move forward.
We also have another comment from Larry Gillington. He's saying, why is it that this civilized world can commemorate genocide but can't stop it from happening in other places? The international community is always silenced when evil is taking place, only to commemorate. Can you hear them? Thank you so much for your comments. Keep them coming.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, talk about the planet. This is our world. Mahatma Gandhi once said, in a gentle way, you can shake the world. One man has literally taken this quote and applied it to reforestation. An organization called Seedballs Kenya believes in replanting seed trees using indigenous seed tree species that thrive in all kinds of weather.
What makes the seeds unique is that they are covered in charcoal dust pellets and lie dormant until it rains. Telma Matsaya in Nairobi got a chance to visit the organization and saw firsthand how they work.
Massive indigenous trees meet you at the entrance of Seedballs Kenya office, located in Lower Kabete. They offer a canopy and give one a sensation of being in a secret garden. However, what catches your eye is acacia trees growing by the roadside. They seem oddly placed. According to the sustainability manager at Cookswell Jikos, housed in the same space, Teddy Kinyanjui, the acacia trees are as a result of local residents and him throwing seedball pellets while walking the dog home.
On the sides of the highways, there are so many of the same species of acacia tree growing for free, in the wild. And because I think of these trees growing directly from seed, they had such a stronger root system. 3, 4, 5 years later, you get big trees. What we found was being able to do direct seeding lowered the costs so much, was more of a natural way for most of these trees to grow by being able to send down a strong tap root, not suffer transplanting shock. It's by protecting that seed inside of this coating of charcoal dust, it can wait there and not be eaten by any of the seed predators.
The indigenous acacia seeds are wrapped in a charcoal pellet to protect them from wild animals and natural elements. These seed balls are thrown directly into the wild by walking adults on camelbacks, children using slingshots, and even passengers aboard helicopters. In order to facilitate this and ensure sustainability, the local communities have to be roped in. Focus on Conservation Areas of East Africa, Land and Life Foundation, conducts conservation education through its flagship Wildlife Warrior program. This includes the popular Wildlife Warrior Club for primary school students, a scholarship program, and a vocational training for school leavers and young adults. The activity started in May last year and involved different schools from Isiolo, Amboseli, to Diani at the Kenyan coast. Steve Raburu is the field coordinator at the Land and Life Foundation, and according to him, over 2,000 kids have benefited from this training.
Once we go to the schools, we take the seed balls and cast them with the children, wait for the favorable conditions to occur, then the seeds germinate at their own time, no rush. So the forest area that the school adapts is a place that is favorable for plant survival. But so far, we have been able to cast roughly 179,000 seeds, individual seed balls. What we anticipate in the next rainy season is at least 10% survival rate.
Hannah Wood is the general manager of the Land and Life Foundation, an independent organization focusing on conservation education and community development. She believes that regeneration has to tie in with everyday living.
The reason I like the seed balling with the children is that it's the young people of Kenya who are going to take this forward. Our aim is by the end of the session, they will not only understand, but they will remember it. They will take it home, share it with the rest of their family. And then when they are in the positions of village committee, village leaders, community leaders in the future, this will be something that is part of who they are.
The rainy season is about to start in Kenya. To date, over 4 million seed balls have been distributed since 2016.
Thelma Mwatsaya.
And just to revisit our top story, it is about Ugandan opposition politician and musician Bobi Wine, who has confirmed to DW that he will be running for the presidency in the next elections, taking on 174-year-old Yoweri Museveni Eunice. The responses and the feedback we are getting are so many. I will read some of them right here live on our Facebook. Monjumane is saying, Africans, let's unite through Bobby and Chase dictatorship in Africa. And Monjumane is saying, my president, Bobby.
Yes, and Med Saku is also writing to us. He's saying, you give us confidence. It's true.
And we have Madou Manka, who says, yes, youth, we stand with you. He's talking about Bobi Wine to repatriate Africa.
And Ex-Queer Kings is saying, I love that comment. We are not free until we are all free. Kudos to you, Bobi Wine. God is your strength. We also have Mbazira Dean, who's saying, did you believe him when he said he wants to restore freedom of expression? Don't be lied to. When it comes to freedom, Uganda has it in excess. Many feel we should get a leader who can reduce a little. Thank you so much for your comments. Also, to bring you back to another story that is making headlines, the Amnesty International has brought out the death penalty report, saying that the number of global executions dropped by 31% in 2018. So this is a good sign. Do check it out on our Facebook page, DW Africa. My name is Eunice Wanjiru.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura.
Bye for now.
DW. Made for Mind.